Dear hackers, Logos members, and other visitors, the world is FUBAR. Human dignity was replaced by a struggle for profit and luxury. Yes, Mr. Darwin, only the fittest will survive. Big corporations are dominating the world, and people are trying to fit somewhere into that corporate jaws to get their share of bloody meat and apple. The others are chewed and devoured. In this hostile environment, there is a community of people fighting for freedom, the freedom of source code. Sharing code is good, they believe, and they are determined to give the world a free operating system and free applications. And they are succeeding, and the community is growing. They were born in 1984, and they call themselves the GNU generation, and are supported by the Free Software Foundation. One man is responsible for making the world a better place, Mr. Richard M. Stallman. The man who wrote Emacs editor, the GNU C compiler, the GNU symbolic debugger, and other GNU programs. For his work, he received Grace Hopper Award, MacArthur Foundation Fellowship, an honorary doctorate from the Royal Institute of Technology in Sweden, Electronic Frontier Foundation's Pioneer Award along with Mr. Linus Torvalds, and Yuri Rubinsky Award. We are very grateful to Mr. Stallman for visiting Slovenia and giving Logos an opportunity to host him for a few days. We hope he enjoyed his trip to Slovenia and Croatia and that he will want to visit us again. We have to thank Hermes Softlab and Literal for supporting the visit. And last but not least, we have to thank Roman Maurer, Aleš Kušer, Damir Horvat and others for organizing and coordinating the visit. Ladies and gentlemen, I am honored to give the word for the second time to Mr. Richard Matthew Stallman.
I never entirely understand what we're applauding, but I figure I better join in to be polite. Well, I am not the only person responsible for the free software community, but I did launch the movement, and today I'm going to speak about what we have done in the free software movement, what our goals are, how we've gone about it, and the philosophy behind it all. Most of the time when people think about the question, what should society's rules be for using software, they are people who work for software companies, and they approach the question in a self-serving way. They ask, what rules can we impose on the users to make them pay us a lot of money and to retain the upper hand, to dominate them? I had the good fortune in the 1970s to be part of a community of programmers who shared software. And because of this, I was led to look at that question from a different direction, to ask what kind of rules permit the users of computers to have a good society, to have a community. And because of that, I reached completely different answers to the question. But let me tell you a bit about what that community was like. Within this community, it was automatic. If you wrote a program, you would share it with anybody who was interested in it. You wanted your work to be of benefit to others. Now, you couldn't always assume that people would do a lot of work for you, but whatever work they had already done, if it was of use to you, you could have it. So, if you walked past another hacker's screen and you saw something interesting, you'd say, hey, what is that? And he would say, oh, that's the new FUBAR program that we just got from Stanford. And it's in the FUBAR directory. By the way, FUBAR is simply the name we would use for anything if we didn't have a better idea for what name to give it. We'd call it FUBAR. And so in that directory, you would find the executable that you could run. In addition, you would find the source code, which you could read and study, so you could see how they solved those problems. In running the program, you might find bugs, or you might have ideas for added features. So you could go to the source code and fix the bugs, or add those features. You could make whatever changes you wanted to make. You could even cut out a piece of that code and put it in some other program you were writing. This we call cannibalizing the old program as a form of joke, because, of course, it wasn't quite the same thing as cannibalizing a machine. Now, since then, some academics have done large studies about how they can encourage code reusability. But we knew that the best way to encourage the reuse of code was to make it available to people who might want to reuse it. So you could use the program not just by running it, but in all the various ways it could be useful. We were, in effect, all working to extend human knowledge. The knowledge we developed was available to humanity to be used. And so our system grew somewhat the way a city grows. You know, over here they build a new building, and over there they tear down a building and replace it with a new one. But meanwhile, in other places, there are old buildings, and as one person after another worked on various parts of a program, it would grow like that. You could look at parts and say, oh, from the style I see, this code must have been written in the 1960s, while over here there's some nice, shiny new code. And it would keep on, we knew it would just keep on growing like that as we had more ideas for how to improve it. For example, to show how this community worked, at one point we needed a cross-assembler that would generate code for the PDP-11, which was a mini-computer, but would run on the PDP-10, which was our main large computer. We could have just written this, but to save time, we looked around to see what was available. I went over to Harvard's computer lab. I was a student there, and it turns out they had a cross-assembler. It was apparently written, I think, by somebody at Digital, but there was no copyright notice on it, and they had the source code. So I made a copy and brought it over to MIT, which is where I worked, where this community was. And there I had to modify it because it was written to run on Digital's time-sharing system, but we needed it to run on our time-sharing system, the incompatible time-sharing system, or ITS for short, which was the system written by hackers for hackers. So I did that, and I added more macro features to the assembler, and then we used it for a few years. Then somebody at the company, BBN, said that he wanted a cross-assembler that would run on their time-sharing system, 10X. So I sent him a copy, he ported it to 10X, and added additional macro features. Then we merged the two versions together to get one combined version with conditionals for the two systems, and the union of all the features. And then we maintained that together for another few years, as long as we kept using those computers. But then we got a taste of what it was like for most people who use computers, people who were not part of a community like ours. This happened when Xerox gave MIT a laser printer. Now, this was a very nice gift because it was the first time anybody outside Xerox had a laser printer. It was actually a high-speed office copier that had been modified with a laser attachment to turn it into a printer. So this thing, in some ways, was very good. It printed a page a second. It had very high resolution, and straight lines came out nice and straight, which was better than our old printer. But the printer had some problems. It was very unreliable. It would frequently get a paper jam. Now, I don't know why this didn't bother the people at Xerox, but it certainly bothered us. And because it was a printer rather than an office copier, there was usually nobody near it. So it would stay jammed for a long time. Now, when we discovered this, we had an idea for what to do, because our old printer had a similar problem. It was slow, and it had low resolution, and it tended to make straight lines come out a bit wavy. But in addition, it got frequent paper jams and often ran out of something. And since we couldn't make the printer itself better, we added features to the software to compensate for the problems of the printer. For instance, whenever a print job finished, the PDP-11 that ran the printer would send a signal to the PDP-10, which would display a message for the user who asked for that printout, saying, "Your file foo has been printed." So you had to wait because the printer was slow, but you didn't have to wait extra just because you didn't know when your job was printed. And there was another feature that I recall adding, which was anytime the printer got in trouble, the PDP-11 would tell the PDP-10, which would display a message for each user who was waiting for printing, saying, "The printer is in trouble, go fix it." Now, if you got that message, you would realize that you couldn't assume someone else would fix the problem, because probably only a few people were getting that message. So you would go to the printer. And as a result, every time the printer got in trouble, a minute later, two or three people would arrive. At least one of them would know how to fix the problem and would teach the others. So the result was the printer always got fixed very soon. In effect, we treated the user as part of the system, and we added end-to-end feedback to obtain reliable operation for the whole system, even though the printer component was still unreliable. Well, this was very nice. So of course when we saw that the new printer was unreliable, we wanted to do a similar thing. But there we ran into a stone wall. We were to add these features to the software for the old printer because that was free software. It was part of the community software. It ran on the PDP-11, and we assembled it with that cross-assembler. So we were able to make changes in it, limited only by our abilities. But the new printer was controlled by proprietary Xerox software running on a proprietary Xerox mini computer. We did not have the source code for that program, and that meant we were completely unable to make changes. Without the source code, even trivial changes like using 4 digits for the year instead of 2 digits are almost impossible. So, in effect, we were totally helpless, even though we were as good programmers as you could have found anywhere. And so, in effect, we were prisoners of our software. And as a result, using that printer was constantly frustrating. You would type the command to print a file, and then you'd go back to work because you knew that it would take a long time. So a while later, you'd notice the time. Oh, it's been half an hour. It's probably not done yet. You go back to work. A while later, you notice the time. Oh, now it's been an hour. Maybe it's printed. So you walk upstairs to the printer, and you see it's been jammed the whole time. So you fix the jam, and you go back to work. And a while later, you notice the time. Oh, it's been another half hour. Maybe it's printed now. So you walk up to the printer, and you see it printed 200 pages of other people's stuff, which was just 3 minutes of printing for that very fast printer, and then jammed again. And at that point, you'd say, I'm going to stand here and fix this damn printer every time it jams until my printout finally comes out. So it wasn't working right, and it was frustrating. But what made it even more frustrating was that the people at Xerox were stopping us from solving the problem. We could have solved this problem, but they were standing in our way. Then I heard that somebody at Carnegie Mellon University had a copy of this source code. Eventually, I had an occasion to visit there, so I went to his office and I said, "Hi, I'm from MIT. Could I have a copy of the printer software source code?" And he said, "No, I promised not to give you a copy." I was so angry and stunned, I didn't know what to say. So all I could do was turn around and walk out of his office without saying another word to him. Well, this was very bad for us at the Artificial Intelligence Lab at MIT, because we never got that source code. We were never able to make these changes, and the printer was frustrating to use for as long as we kept using it. But in a paradoxical way, it was very good for me, because it taught me an important lesson, a lesson that most programmers don't learn. You see, he had promised he would refuse to cooperate with me and with the rest of us at MIT, refused to cooperate with his colleagues at MIT. But he didn't just do this to us. I think he probably did the same thing to you. And chances are, he did the same thing to you. And I expect he most likely did the same thing to you. He probably did the same thing to you. You see, he had done the same thing to just about everybody in the world, promised to refuse to help them out if they needed his help. Because he had signed a non-disclosure agreement. This was my first direct encounter with a non-disclosure agreement. I was the victim. I and my whole lab were the victims. And the lesson it taught me was that non-disclosure agreements have victims. They're not innocent. They're not harmless. Now, most programmers don't learn this, because most programmers first encounter a non-disclosure agreement when they are invited to sign one. And there's always some temptation, some goodie that they're going to get if they sign. So they make up excuses. They say, they will never get a copy of this in any case, so why shouldn't I join in the conspiracy to deprive them? They say, this is the way it's always done. Who am I to resist? They say, if I don't do this, somebody else will. Various excuses to gag their consciences and ignore the fact that they're about to betray their colleagues by promising to refuse to cooperate with them. But when somebody invited me to sign a non-disclosure agreement, I had already experienced what it was to be the victim. And I had been very angry at that. So my conscience was already alerted to the issue, and there was no way it would be silenced. So I could not sign. I said, thank you very much for offering me this nice software package, but I cannot in good conscience accept the conditions you have set. So I will do without it. No thank you. And so I have never knowingly signed a non-disclosure agreement for generally useful technical information, such as software. There are other kinds of information, of course. For example, there is personal information, which raises completely different ethical issues. Here, I'm talking about published useful information, information that somehow or other is supposed to be available for people to use. So, if you were to say, wanted to talk with me about what was happening between you and your girlfriend, and you asked me, please, would I not tell anybody, I could agree to that, because that is not generally useful technical information. At least, it probably isn't. Now, I could imagine that you might disclose to me some marvelous new sex technique, and I might then feel a duty to humanity to pass it on to other people who might be able to make use of it. But if you just wanted to talk to me about, you know, what you were arguing about and who it hurt whose feelings how and what could you do about it, things like that, knowing those details of your life would not help everybody live their lives better. There's no reason why it's important to publish this information. So I could say yes. But when it comes to the information that is the substance of science and engineering, the information which it is the mission of these fields to develop for humanity, if we conceal it instead, we are betraying the mission of our field. And this I decided I would not do. The free software movement comes from that ethical decision. Because at about the same time I was thinking about this, having that experience and reaching this conclusion, a series of calamities was falling on my community, which ultimately wiped it out. The last nail in the coffin was when Digital discontinued the PDP-10. And since the whole incompatible time-sharing system was written in assembler language for the PDP-10, as soon as the PDP-10 was discontinued, in effect, all of our work turned into dust and blew away. It was all useless. It was only of historical interest. Get a computer and use it. Was to sign a non-disclosure agreement to get a proprietary operating system. So I found myself in a situation where the only way I could continue working as an operating system developer was to do exactly what I had decided was basically wrong and decided I would not do. So this put me in a moral dilemma. I couldn't continue working in the way I had done, because that depended on being part of the community which no longer existed and working on the body of software which was obsolete. So what could I do? Well, the obvious alternative was to accept this change in the world and adapt myself to it, to start signing non-disclosure agreements and using proprietary software. And I'm sure MIT would have had me developing proprietary software as well, because MIT had already done that kind of thing. I thought about this and I realized that this way I could have fun programming and I could make money, especially if I left MIT and did it someplace else. But at the end of my career, I would have to look back and say, I have spent my life building walls to divide people. And I would have been ashamed, completely ashamed of what I had been working on. So I looked for another alternative. And there was an obvious alternative. I could leave the field of software. Now, many programmers seem not to believe that this is a possibility. They say, the people who hire programmers demand this, this, and this. If I don't do it, I'll starve. That's literally the words they use. Well, even today, even in the U.S., there are millions of people who are making a living not in the software field, and they're not starving. So I think those people are exaggerating the difficulty. Now, I had no other special skills, but I'm sure I could have become a waiter. Not at a fancy restaurant, I guess, but I could have been a waiter somewhere. Now, one thing about being a waiter is you're not doing anything wrong to people. Well, maybe if you're working at McDonald's, you are, but but in general, you're not doing anything unethical being a waiter. And another thing is, as a waiter, you're not going to starve. So I had found an ethical alternative. This meant I was not entitled to say to myself, I am justified in doing something unethical because it's the only way I can survive. No, I had another ethical way to survive. But I saw that being a waiter would be no fun for me, and it would be wasting my skills. It would avoid misusing my skills, but it would still be wasting them. So I decided to look for another alternative. What could an operating system developer do that would make the world a better place instead of a worse place? And I realized that an operating system developer was exactly what we needed, because the moral dilemma existed because all of the available operating systems were proprietary. If an operating system developer or a group of them were to write another operating system and then say to everybody, come and get it, share this, do what you want, we could give everybody another way out of the dilemma, a way to use computers in freedom and community once again. And I realized that this was the most important thing I could possibly do. It was a big job. I didn't know if I could possibly succeed, but at least it was worth trying to do. And the other things I could have done that would be merely technical improvements were not worth trying to do. If they didn't give people freedom, they were not worth trying to do. But this, at least, if we could do it, would be a step forward for society. So I resolved to develop a free operating system. Well, this led to some technical questions. What should this system look like? Well, I had just seen a whole system turn into dust and blow away because it was written for one particular kind of computer which became obsolete. I didn't want to write another system and have it turn into dust also. So it was clear this system would have to be portable. There was just one portable operating system I knew of that was actually a practical success, and that was Unix. Unix also had some good ideas, features such as pipes, redirection of I.O., shell programming, the convenient fork and exec system calls that people actually used. These were advanced compared with other systems. In addition, I realized that it would be really important to make this system compatible with Unix, upward compatible. And the reason is users do not like incompatible changes, and they tend to do that only when it's absolutely necessary. So I realized if I took the best ideas from the systems I had helped to develop and from other systems I had used or read about and put them together with my own favorite ideas, I could have developed my dream operating system, and if I had finished this and offered it to the users, they would have said, well, you know, this is really very nice, but it's incompatible, and we've already written our programs to run on Unix. It would be a big job to switch to your system, so we're not going to use it. Now, if I had just wanted an excuse, if I had wanted an excuse to say, I offered them the system, they didn't take it, now it's not my fault, then I could have done this. but I wanted to create a real community that would have real people living in it and enjoying the benefits of liberty. And to achieve that, I had to make a system that people would choose to use. Compatibility with Unix, I realized, was vital for this. Now, Unix consists of many different components that communicate through interfaces that are more or less documented. So if you're going to be compatible with Unix, that means you have to replace each component and make it. So all the design decisions were made. The only other thing I needed was a name. Now, we hackers, we love to pick funny or mischievous names for programs, because thinking of people laughing at the name is half the fun of writing the program. And there was an old hacker tradition that when you write a program which is similar to an existing program, you can give the new one a name, which is a recursive acronym that says that this program is not that program. For instance, in the 60s and 70s, there were many Kiko text editors, more or less similar, and most of them were called something Tico. But one clever hacker had the idea of calling his version Tint, for Tint is not Tico, the first recursive acronym. In 1975, I developed the first Emacs extensible text editor. And there were many imitations of Emacs, and many of them were called something Emacs. But one was called Fine, for Fine is not Emacs. And then there was Sign, for Sign is not Emacs. And then there was Ina, for Ina is not Emacs. And then Ina was almost completely rewritten, and the new version was called Zwei, for Zwei was Ina initially. So I decided to look for a recursive acronym name for something is not Unix. However, a minute of thinking told me that none of those possibilities was a word, so it wouldn't be very funny. In order for it to be funny, it has to have another meaning. So I looked for another way to do it. I tried a contraction so that I could get three-letter recursive acronyms, and I discovered that the word GNU, which is one of the funniest words in the English language, could be used. It could stand for GNUs, not Unix. The reason why people use the word GNU for so much wordplay is, according to the dictionary, it's pronounced new. And so people ask, you know, what's GNU? There's even a funny song about the word GNU. So once I discovered I could use that word, there couldn't be a better name than that. I should point out, by the way, that this is the name of an animal that lives in Africa. And the African pronunciation has a click sound in it. When the British colonized the area, they didn't bother learning to pronounce this click sound. They just pronounced it new, and they wrote it with a G, meaning there's some other sound here that we are not pronouncing. I've been invited to visit South Africa next June, and so one thing I hope to do there is learn to pronounce the name correctly. But in any case, when it's the name of this operating system, please pronounce a hard G. Pronounce it GNU. If you talk about the new operating system, you'll get people very confused, because we've been working on it now for almost 17 years. So it's not new anymore, but it still is, and it always will be GNU, no matter how many people call it Linux by mistake. So, we had a name we could start the project. I announced it on the network, asking people to write to me if they wanted to help. And in January 1984, I quit my job at MIT to start writing GNU. Now, there was a good reason for me to quit my job. If I were an MIT employee, MIT would have an excuse to claim to own the software I wrote. And And they could have turned it into a proprietary software product. And if that had happened, they could have ruined the whole thing. The whole purpose of this work was to give people freedom. If it were going to be proprietary, I would rather not have written it at all. So to make sure that MIT could not interfere, I quit my job. And I have never had a job since then. But the lab director was kind enough to let me keep using one of the machine's facilities, one of the machines there, which was a Unix machine. And this was when I actually started using Unix for the first time. I was never a Unix wizard the way some people were. I made this decision to follow the design of Unix for the reason that I've given you. Fortunately, when I started using it and discovered the various problems of Unix, they were not fatal problems. It still seemed like a good idea to be compatible with Unix. Now, at the time, I believed we would develop all these different pieces and make a whole system, and then people would start to use it. That's not what happened. In September 1984, I started working on GNU Emacs, which was my second implementation of the Emacs text editor. By early 1985, it was working well enough that I could do all my editing with it, which meant that other people also wanted to do their editing with it. People, say, who had got used to Emacs on the PDP-10 and wanted to have Emacs on their Unix systems. So they started asking me for copies. And that meant I had to work out the details of how to distribute it. Of course, I put a copy in the anonymous FTP directory. That was good for people who were on the net. But in 1985, most programmers even were not on the net. So I was getting email from people saying, I'm not on the net. How can I get a copy? Well, I could have said to them, I want to spend my time writing more GNU software, not writing tapes. So please, find a friend who's on the net who will download it for you. And I'm sure they would have found somebody and they would have got a copy after a certain amount of searching. But I had no job, and I was looking for some way I could make money from my work on free software. So I announced, send me $150 and I'll send you a tape of Emacs. And the orders began dribbling in. By the middle of the year, they were trickling in. I was getting 8 to 10 orders a month. And if necessary, I could actually have lived on that. The reason is that I live cheaply. I have always had a practice of refusing to pick up expensive habits. I'm very suspicious of anything that other people seem to want to keep spending money on. And I think, well, can I avoid this thing? You know, most Americans, especially, if an American starts making this much money, he immediately starts looking for a way to spend this much money. You know, if he saved anything, that would be no good. So they start buying houses and cars and boats and airplanes and paintings and stamps, adventure vacations, children, all these expensive luxuries, and once they have them, they seem to feel that they're hooked and they can never do without them again, which means that they are always forced to do whatever will get them the most money. They have no choices in their lives anymore. They become essentially the puppet of money. Whereas if you resist these expensive habits, then you'll find that you can choose what to do with your life. You can do what you think is really important instead of what somebody with money tells you to do. So, some people used to say to me, though, what do you mean it's free software if it costs $150? Well, the English word free has multiple meanings. One of them refers to price. Another meaning refers to freedom. When I say free software, I'm talking about freedom, not price. So think of free speech, not free beer. Some people got their copies of Emacs from me through the network without paying me. Others got their copies on tape by paying me. And other people got their copies not from me, but from somebody else. And maybe they paid that somebody else, but they didn't pay me. So for some of these people, Emacs was gratis, and for others it was not. But for all of these users, it gave freedom. All of these users had the basic freedoms necessary to participate in a community. And that's what it means to say that Emacs was and is free software. So what are these freedoms? At this point, I should give you the definition of free software. A program is free software for you, a particular user, if you have the following freedoms. Freedom 0 is the freedom to run the program for any purpose. Freedom 1 is the freedom to help yourself by modifying the program to suit your needs. Freedom 2 is the freedom to help your neighbor by distributing copies of the program. And freedom 3 is the freedom to help build your community by publishing an improved version so other people can get the benefit of your work. If you have all of these freedoms, then the program is free software for you. Freedom 0 is something that most programs give you. So while there are some programs that try to restrict you and don't even let you have that freedom, they are particularly restrictive programs. Also, legally speaking, if you have freedoms 1, 2, and 3, freedom 0 follows as a consequence. So I think I don't have to say very much about freedom 0. The freedoms that distinguish free software from typical software are freedoms 1, 2, and 3. So I'll say more about those freedoms and why they are important. Freedom 1 is the freedom to help yourself by changing the software to suit your needs. For example, you might want to fix some bugs. You might want to add new features. You might want to port it to another computer system. You might want to translate all the commands and messages to Slovenian. Any change you want to make, you should be able to make. Of course, to really be able to do this effectively, you have to have access to the source code. So access to the source code is a precondition for freedom number 1. Who can benefit from freedom number 1? Well, obviously, any trained programmer can make use of freedom number 1 to make changes. In addition, any business that uses software can make use of freedom number 1. Now, maybe this is not a computer business. They just use computers. But if they want changes made, they can go to a bunch of programmers somewhere and say, how much will you charge to make these changes for us? And so they can get the benefit of this freedom even though they personally don't have the skills to do the work. Just as a business can hire a carpenter to move the walls inside the building or a plumber to put in a new sink. They don't have to be a plumbing company or a building company to benefit from being able to do these changes. Anyone who values security and privacy on the computer can benefit from this freedom, because with proprietary software, there's no way you can check what it's really doing. So if it has a bug that compromises the security or makes your information available, you can't tell. You just have to have blind faith in the developer. It might even have a Trojan horse deliberately put in, and there's no way you can tell. But if you and the other users have access to the source code, then people are checking parts of the program. And this means that if there's an accidental bug, there's a better chance it will be fixed. And it also means that deliberately introduced Trojan horses might get spotted, which means that people might hesitate to put them in because they would expect to be caught. It's not a guarantee, nothing is, but it helps. And because of this, experts on security now recommend that software for security should be free software. However, when your computer is on a network, all of the software on it plays a role in maintaining the security and the privacy on the computer. Finally, any intelligent person can learn some programming to do an easy job if he wants to. After all, there are big jobs and there are little easy jobs. Most people are not going to learn to become professional programmers who can do the big jobs. But anybody can learn a little to do an easy job. So anybody can take advantage of this freedom, anybody who wants to. Now, if you don't have this freedom, that causes practical material harm to society. People become prisoners of their software. I already explained what this is like with regard to the laser printer, so there's no need to repeat it. But this also causes a kind of psychosocial harm, which affects people's morale, their enthusiasm for their work. If you go to work and you're excited about getting your work done, and every day it's hard because somebody is deliberately stopping you from getting the work done in the most expeditious way, you're going to feel frustrated. And when people feel frustrated over and over again, they protect themselves by deciding not to care anymore. So you end up with an attitude like, well, I showed up for work today. I brought my book. So if I can't get work done, I'll just get paid to read my book. It's all the same to me. And so when this happens, it hurts both the people it happens to and society as a whole. That's freedom number one, the freedom to help yourself by changing the program to suit your needs. Freedom number two is the freedom to help your neighbor by distributing copies of the program to other people so that they can use it too. When beings can think and have knowledge, a fundamental act of friendship is sharing knowledge. When these beings use computers, this act of friendship takes the form of sharing software. If you don't have this freedom, if a program has an owner who succeeds, never mind by what method, who succeeds in establishing a situation where everyone must pay to use the program, this causes practical material harm to society. It causes the program to go to waste, because it sets up a financial disincentive discouraging the use of the program. Some users will say, all right, I'll pay. And others will say, never mind, it's too much, I'll do without it. And every time somebody says, I'll do without it, the program is going partly to waste. But the work it takes to write the program to any given level of power and quality is the same, regardless of the number of users. So the same work is done, but only part of the possible benefit is achieved. The rest is deliberately inflicted waste, which is material harm. But because it's inflicted by stopping people from helping each other, it also causes psychosocial harm, which affects the spirit of goodwill, the willingness to help your neighbor, which is society's most important resource. which makes the difference between a livable society, which is good to live in, and a dog-eat-dog jungle where people are only trying to hurt each other. This spirit is so important that the world's major religions try actively to encourage it. When I was a kid going to school, as a little kid, the teachers were trying to teach this attitude. They said, if you bring candy to school, you can't just eat all of it yourself. You have to share some with the other kids. Now they're being told to do the exact opposite. They're saying, oh, you brought software to school. Well, don't share. Sharing is wrong. So what does this do to society when major social institutions are trying to tell people that they shouldn't share with their neighbors? This is perverse. It's sick. And what happens when governments actually start threatening to put people in prison? What happens when they start saying, if you share with your neighbor, that means you're a pirate? They're saying that helping your neighbor is the moral equivalent of attacking a ship. You know, that's a very perverted moral view. And when they start putting people in prison for years for helping with their neighbor, for helping their neighbor, we have to wonder how much fear is it going to take to get people to stop helping their neighbors? Do you want to live in a society permeated by that level of fear? I don't. And I think this is the most important reason why software should be free, because only a police state can succeed in scaring people out of helping their neighbors. It's going to take a lot of fear. The Soviet Union put a lot of effort into stamping out the unauthorized copying of information, an activity that was known as samizdat. And they used several methods. For example, every copier had to have a guard watching what was copied to make sure no unauthorized copying was going on. And they used harsh punishments for anyone caught doing unauthorized copying. You know, you'd be sent to Siberia for years. And then to catch people, they asked everyone to inform on their co-workers and their neighbors, basically turning everybody into rats. And then further, to help catch people, they used collective responsibility, conscripting people to watch other people. You're going to watch that group. If I catch any of them doing unauthorized copying, you are going to prison, so you better watch them good. And, of course, they used propaganda, starting in childhood, to tell people that only a horrible enemy of the people would ever do this unauthorized copying. The United States today is using all of these same methods to stop unauthorized copying. First, guards watching copiers. Well, in fact, the Xerox stores have guards watching copiers for this same purpose. But beyond that, because your computer is a copier, obviously they can't afford to have a human being watching your computer, so instead they use robot guards. There is software that goes into your computer which is designed to stop you from copying, and it's a crime to bypass that software. Second, harsh punishments. Well, a few years ago, if you made copies of something and handed them out to your friends just to be nice, this was not a crime. It had never been a crime. Today, it's a felony. You can be put in prison for years for this. And they're talking about increasing the penalties because apparently it takes a lot of fear to get people to stop helping their neighbors. And, well, informers. In the past year, there were ads on television in the U.S. asking people to rat on their coworkers to the information police, otherwise known as the Software Publishers Association. and collective responsibility. In the U.S., that has been done using internet service providers. They have been made responsible for everything that their customers post. And the only way they can escape sharing the punishment is if they have an automatic policy where they take everything down within 2 weeks after a complaint. The result is that if you were accused of copyright violations today, normally you don't even get a chance to have your day in court. Instead, your site just gets unplugged, and there's nothing you can do. There's no appeal. And finally, propaganda starting in childhood. Well, the way the U.S. government put it, teachers were supposed to teach the kids to, quote, say yes to licensing, unquote, which results in the teachers saying, oh, you brought software to school. Well, don't share it with the other kids. Sharing means you're a pirate. That propaganda word again. Please don't ever use the term pirate to describe people who share with their neighbors. So I think it's no coincidence that similar methods are in use, because if you want to stop people from sharing information with their neighbors, it's hard to do it. Draconian police state methods are required. Not just that they have to be draconian police state methods, but they have to be particular draconian police state methods. Any country that tries to do this has to use the same methods. They're the only way to do it. And if we don't want that kind of society, we have to reject this government policy. That is, I believe, the most important reason why software should be free. And that ends my discussion of freedom number two, the freedom to help your neighbor. Freedom three is the freedom to help build your community by publishing an improved version of the program. When I released GNU Emacs, people said to me, well, if free software won't make sense, you know, if it's free software, then nobody will be paid to work on it, which means nobody will work on it. Now, obviously, these people were confusing the two meanings of the word free, but in any case, that was their theory. Today, we can compare this theory with observed fact. According to John Gilmore, who founded the first free software development company, there are now thousands of people getting paid to work on free software. And there are tens of thousands who are working on free software part-time as volunteers. Just one development site has 20,000 registered developers. And that is not the whole community. People do this for many reasons. You know, it could be a matter that programming is fun. It's partly a matter of pride. If you release a free program and 100,000 people use it and like it, they're going to really like you. It's partly a matter of wanting a reputation. You know, in that circumstance, you can say, I wrote this program, and people will be impressed. It's partly a matter of political idealism. That's what my biggest motivation is, although the others are part of my feelings as well. Partly it's a matter of wanting to give something back to the community that you have benefited from. Partly it's a matter that you need a program to do a certain job, so you write it. And then once you've written it, you figure, oh, I might as well give this to the community, and other people might like it too. So these reasons in various combinations motivate different people. When people started using GNU Emacs, after a while, because there were various other programmers looking at the source code, somebody sent me a message saying, I think I found a bug, here's a fix. And another message, here's a new file that adds a new feature. Here's another bug fix, and another new feature, and another, until they were pouring in at me so fast that just making use of all the help I was getting was a big burden. Microsoft doesn't have this problem. And since then, people have noted this phenomenon, that when a free program catches on, it often creates a community of people together working to improve it. And so free software, you know, in the 1980s, people used to make silly, basically naive a priori statements, like if it's free software, it won't work. But now free software is getting a reputation for being powerful and reliable because of this community development. There is even a group of people who have focused on this particular reason as the main reason why software ought to be free. That group calls itself the open source movement. Now, the open source movement focuses on trying to persuade business. And they recommend more or less the same set of freedoms that we do in the free software movement. But when they say why, they only mention the practical benefits. They don't talk about things such as freedom, the importance of a good community, ethics, living an upright life. They just cite how it leads to more powerful, reliable software and will be an advantage for your business. So what they say is right as far as it goes, but they leave out the most important thing. You know, if you look at life solely in terms of what's going to be good for business and ignoring what makes for a good life, you're missing something tremendously important. And this is the main disagreement between the open source movement and the free software movement that I am speaking for. And in fact, by omitting these things, they're making a statement by omission, which I disagree with very strongly. To show you what that means, imagine people were discussing whether to have free elections for political offices. And imagine that somebody said, you know, it costs an awful lot of money to run these elections. We should save money by not having elections. This person is obviously missing the point, because he's looking at a sort of minor detail and trying to decide based on that. Implicitly, he's denying the existence of all the more important issues which should affect this decision. In the same way, when the open source people focus on purely the practical benefits, they are implicitly denying that there are any ethical issues, any political, social issues at stake. So that is the implicit disagreement between the two movements, and it's at the very foundation of the thinking. Nonetheless, because they do similar work to what we do in practice, we can work with them on practical activities like developing software. And they have done some useful things for our community. But in order for us to resist the challenges we face, we need to think about freedom. And therefore, it's extremely important to talk about the issue of freedom. Now, you, of course, can make up your own mind where you stand on these issues. You can support the free software movement. You could support the open source movement. You could support neither one. You can have whatever opinions you want. But I would like to ask you, invite you to support the free software movement. And if you do, I would like you to express your support to other people by using the term free software. The term free software is our banner. The term open source is the banner of the other philosophy. And by choosing which banner to wave, you will express support for one set of views or another. So if you agree with us, please make that clear to people. And please talk about these issues of freedom. When you encounter other people who are discussing things as if these issues of freedom didn't matter, it's up to you to raise the issue. to remind people that there are things at stake here besides just how to have powerful, reliable software. So if you don't have freedom number three, that causes practical material harm. Which is the camera stopped now?
In a minute.
Oh, okay. Tell me when it is, of course. It causes practical material harm because this phenomenon of community development can't happen, and so you don't get powerful, reliable software. But it also causes psychosocial harm, which affects the spirit of scientific cooperation, which is essential for the progress of human knowledge. The idea that knowledge should be available to humanity so that we can all work together extending knowledge. So these are the three freedoms that distinguish free software from most software, and the six reasons why they are important. If you, a particular user, have these freedoms, then the program is free software for you. Now, why do I formulate the definition this way with respect to a particular user? The reason is because sometimes a program can be free for some users and non-free for other users. That might seem strange, so let me give you an example to illustrate how it happens. The biggest example of this that I know of was the X window system, which was developed by a group at MIT and released as free software. They used a license. The license they used was such that if you got a copy from MIT, you had all of these freedoms. So it would be free software for you. We will now have a pause for station identification. It's working? Because it's not blinking anymore. Okay. If you got a copy of X Windows from MIT, you would have all these essential freedoms, so it would be free software for you. But among those who got copies from MIT were various computer manufacturers that took X Windows, ported it to run on their versions of Unix and their computers, and then they took just the binaries and put them into their Unix system and distributed them to customers under the same non-disclosure agreement as the rest of Unix. And so hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people got copies of X in this way, and they had none of these freedoms. For them, it was just as proprietary as Unix. So this created a paradoxical situation where if you ask the question, is X free software or not, the answer depended on where you made the measurement. If you made the measurement coming out of the developers group at MIT, you'd say, I observe all these freedoms, it's free software. If you made the measurement among the users, you'd say, mostly I observe the absence of these freedoms, it's not free software. Well, the people who developed X Windows were not looking to give the users freedom. They were looking for a big success. And they got one. They set a de facto standard. So they didn't care that most of the users did not have freedom. But in the GNU project, our goal was specifically to give the users freedom. And if this thing that happened with X Windows were to happen with GNU, then GNU would be a failure. So I looked for a method to stop this from happening. And the method I came up with is called copyleft. That name is because you can think of it as taking copyright and flipping it over. The idea is, where copyright is normally one of the methods used to deny users their freedom, instead, we use copyright to defend the user's freedom. Here's how it works. First, we say this program is copyrighted. which means by default it's prohibited to modify it or distribute it. But then we say, you are authorized to modify this program. You are authorized to redistribute copies of this program. You are authorized to distribute modified and extended versions of this program. But there is a condition. The condition says, anything you distribute which contains any part of this must be distributed on these conditions, no more and no less. Which means that whoever gets his copy from you must get from you the same freedom that you got from me. So wherever the program goes, the freedom goes with it. The freedom and the program become inseparable. In effect, these freedoms become inalienable rights, rights that nobody can lose, at least for this particular software. We can't do this for all published software, although we would like to, but we can do it for the software that we write. The specific form of copyleft, the specific implementation that we use for most GNU software is the GNU General Public License, which is a license that spells out the terms for copying and redistribution, and it is designed so that you can easily drop it into your program and then release it, and your program is copylefted. We also have a couple of other forms of copyleft that we use in special cases for a few particular GNU programs. And we also have a kind of copyleft for manuals, which is called the GNU Free Documentation License. Now, this license was published last March, and the goal is to obtain the cooperation of commercial publishers in publishing free manuals for free software. Now, of course, these manuals are free as in freedom, not free as in price. I expect them to print copies and sell those copies in bookstores. But in order for them to fully contribute to our community, they need to be free in the sense of freedom. Other people need to be free to redistribute copies and publish modified versions. The GNU Free Documentation License has certain freedoms that I hope will make it easier for a publisher to make a profit while contributing to our free documentation. So there are, within our community, there is copylefted free software. In fact, most free software packages are copylefted because the GNU General Public License is used apparently for more than half of all free software packages. And there is also non-copylefted free software like X-Windows, like Pech. Both of them are free software. Both of them are available to our community. In one case, because you see, well, in both cases, the developers respect your freedom. They do not try to take away your freedom. In the case of copylefted free software, the developers are actively organizing the defense of freedom. In the case of non-copylefted free software, the developers are not trying to organize the defense of freedom, so it's up to you to remain vigilant and refuse to give up your freedom. The developers will not try to help organize you to do this. But you can get the program with freedom. So both of these kinds of free software contribute to our community, and both can be part of a free operating system. The disagreement is one of strategy. So during the 1980s, our job in the GNU project was to fill in all these gaps to get a complete replacement for the Unix system. Now, because the job was a very big one, we had to look for shortcuts. After all, most people were saying we couldn't possibly ever finish the job. And they were right. It was a very big job. I didn't know if we could finish it. So we were always looking for cases where somebody else wrote a program which could be put into service for part of the system and which was free. And if we found one that was suitable, we used it. For instance, I decided at the very beginning that GNU should have a Windows system. Unix at the time did not have a Windows system, but I had written a couple of Windows systems for research before that, and I certainly wanted GNU to be convenient like the Macintosh. So I decided we should have a Windows system. But a few years later, I saw X, and I saw that it was becoming popular, and it did the job. So I decided we won't write a Windows system for GNU. We will just use X. So that we saved one very large piece of the job. And in other cases, we found other software that was available that could become part of the GNU system. Because to develop, the goal was to produce the whole system, which didn't mean that we had to be the author of each one of these components. However, only occasionally did we find a suitable component. There were many other components that we never found, and we had to write them, or else recruit somebody else to write them. And that's what most of our work was in the 1980s. In October 1985, we started the Free Software Foundation, which is a tax-exempt charity in the U.S., whose mission is to promote users' freedom to share and change software. And so we started asking for donations so that we could hire programmers to write parts of GNU. In fact, there's nothing left. If you could get me some water even, that would be nice. Thank you. And so the foundation began asking for donations. But in addition, it took over from me the business of selling tapes of GNU Emacs. Nowadays, we don't sell tapes anymore. We sell CD-ROMs. And we also sell nice printed manuals. So buying manuals from the Free Software Foundation is one way and also buying CD-ROMs and buying T-shirts, that's one way you can contribute to supporting the free software movement and the GNU project. Now, when we had enough money to... Leaving so soon? Aww. So, when we had enough money to pay one person, I had to make the decision, would that one person be Stallman or somebody else? But I realized that paying Stallman a salary would be throwing the money away because we could get Stallman to work for nothing. So, since it was my responsibility to spend the money wisely, I decided to hire somebody else instead. And a number of important parts of the GNU system, like the shell and the C library, were written by the staff of the Free Software Foundation. But most of the work in the GNU project was done by volunteers. Now, some of it was done by full-time volunteers like me. There are other full-time volunteers. What it means is the Free Software Foundation isn't paying them. Most of these full-time volunteers are getting paid by somebody else to do the work. And now there are many people being paid by a number of companies to improve GNU software in various ways. But a lot of work is done by part-time volunteers who are not getting paid at all, but find occasions to contribute. Eventually, we had enough of the pieces of the system that it seemed useful to make a list of what was still missing. At the beginning, that wasn't necessary. It was easier to make a list of what we had than what was missing. But eventually, what we had got to be big enough that it was easier to make a list of what was missing. So I sat down with a Unix wizard and we made a list, which became the GNU task list. We still have a GNU task list. Today, it no longer consists of pieces of Unix that are missing. Nowadays, it's mostly a bunch of application programs that we think we should have. Because why did I start with an operating system? The reason is the operating system is the first thing you need if you want to start using a computer. Without an operating system, you can't do anything. But once you have an operating system, you may want other things as well. And the issues of freedom are important for any software that is published. So now that we have a free operating system, we want to have free applications too. And you can find the GNU task list on our website, which is www.gnu.org. By 1991, the system was almost finished. One only of the major pieces was still missing, and that was the kernel. We started developing a kernel in 1990. As always, I was looking for shortcuts, some way we could use existing working software to do part of the job. I found out about a microkernel called Mach, which was developed at Carnegie Mellon as part of a big funded project. And in 1990, they released it as free software, which meant that we were able to start working on doing the rest of the job. Mach is called a microkernel because it doesn't provide all the features of, say, the Unix kernel. And so we had to write the user programs that would run on top of Mach and do the rest of the jobs. Thank you. And I thought that since Mach was already running, that this would be easy and we would save time this way. It didn't work out that way. It turned out that writing these multi-threaded asynchronous programs was very difficult. They were prone to timing errors and debugging them was very hard. And it took many years to get this kernel to work at all. Fortunately, people did not have to wait for this. Because in 1991, Linus Torvalds, a college student, wrote a kernel also. He used the tried and true monolithic approach, and he got his kernel to work, it was barely working within a year, although it took a couple more years before it really had all the features one needed in order to make it usable. And so people started, we didn't know about this kernel, which was called Linux, because he never communicated with us about it. But he did announce it in places on the net. So people who knew about Linux decided to look around and see if they could find the rest of the system so that they could make a complete system. So they looked around, and lo and behold, everything they needed was already available. What good fortune, they thought. It's all here already. But actually, there was no luck about it. They had found all the various pieces waiting to be made into the GNU system, except that we couldn't really do that until we had a kernel. So they put them together, and in fact, they were fitting Linux into the gap in the GNU system. But they didn't realize that. They thought they were starting with Linux and making a system on top of it. So, in actuality, the system they made was the combination of GNU and Linux. In other words, it's the GNU/Linux system. But they thought it was essentially Linux with a few things added, and so they called it a Linux system. And so this is how today, some 20 million people are using versions of the GNU system, and mostly they don't know it. Now, the development of Linux was an important step forward for free software, because that filled the last crucial gap in the system. It in effect, that step brought us to the finish line of having a complete free operating system that you could install on your computer and use, which was our initial target. But the confusion of calling the whole system Linux was a terrible setback for the free software movement because it broke the connection between our philosophy and our software. See, until that time, people who used our software knew that they were GNU users, and so it called their attention to the GNU philosophy. And so they would take a look at it. After all, they liked the GNU software, and they saw this is why we wrote the software, so they would take it seriously. They might or might not agree, but at least they'd think about it. And if they agreed, then they would be motivated to develop more GNU software. So the software spread the philosophy, and the philosophy helped to build and extend the software. But once people started calling the whole GNU system Linux, then the software no longer led to our philosophy. Instead, it led to the philosophy associated with the name Linux, which is the philosophy of Linus Torvalds, which is essentially apolitical. It's the more or less what became the open source movement. Now, those people have a right to promote their views, but it's a real problem for us that our work is promoting their views instead of ours. So this is why I ask you, when you're talking about the operating system that we were the principal developers of and which Linus Torvalds also contributed to, please don't call it Linux. Please give us a share of the credit by calling it GNU/Linux. It's not only the right thing to do to give credit to the principal developer of the system, but it will also help people recognize the importance of our philosophy, the same philosophy I've been telling you today, in bringing this system into existence so that people will think about it and more people will agree with it, and then they will stand up firmly for freedom, and then we may overcome the challenges we face, because we face real challenges. We have made a good beginning, but we haven't completely won. Our freedom is not assured for the future. Well, freedom is never assured. You always have to keep defending your freedom, because there will always be people who try to entice you into giving it up so that they can control you and keep you helpless. And if you're willing to trade your freedom for some kind of advantage, you will lose your freedom. But the most important thing we need in order to keep our freedom and extend it is to remember the goal. Today, our community is getting terribly close to forgetting it. Because if you look at most of the institutions in our community, they don't talk about freedom. Most of them support the philosophy of the open source movement, which they think is more profitable. And most of them, of course, call the system Linux, which means that the users are never even informed about the GNU project and its philosophy. So, for example, if you look at the companies that package the GNU/Linux system and sell copies, most of them put in some non-free software. Actually, all of them put in non-free software as well. So, it's possible today to get a complete free operating system, but you have to look pretty hard to find one. If you go to the store and you pick up a copy of the GNU system that is called Linux, chances are it's going to have non-free software in it. And in fact, the users have come to think of this as a bonus. And nowadays, in fact, if you offer them a system which is entirely free, they're going to say, hey, well, why isn't there this neat non-free program and that non-free program? I'm used to those programs now. So the result is that it's hard to even get people to consider using a complete free system. So all of these companies, by distributing non-free software, are encouraging users to accept non-free software, encouraging users to let their freedom slip. And what about the magazines about the use of the GNU/Linux system? Most of these magazines call themselves Linux something or other, and they call the system Linux. And most of them are full of advertisements for non-free software. Now, those advertisements are for many different programs, but there's a message that they all have in common, which is non-free software is good for you. It's so good, you might even pay to get a copy. And they call these things value-added packages, which makes a statement about values. It says, value convenience and expediency, don't value freedom and community. Now, since I disagree with those values, I have a different name for those packages. I call them freedom subtracted packages. Because if you have installed a complete free operating system, if you are enjoying the benefits of freedom that we have worked for 17 years to give you, those packages give you an opportunity to buckle on some chains. And what about the trade shows about the GNU/Linux operating system? Well, mostly they call themselves Linux trade shows, and they're full of companies advertising non-free software, and thus, in effect, they're endorsing it. And by calling the system Linux, they never lead people to the GNU project where they might see the idea that there's a problem here. And what about the users groups for the users of the GNU/Linux system? Well, mostly those users call themselves Linux users, which is a mistake because they're mainly GNU users. And mostly these groups call themselves Linux user groups. And most of them, I'm sad to say, invite salesmen to come and present non-free software. And in effect, these groups are thus endorsing the idea that non-free software is okay, rejecting the goal of freedom. So our community is coming very, very close to forgetting all about the goal of freedom. Now, people carelessly dismiss our idealism, saying that it's impractical. But actually, if you're trying to reach a goal that is going to take many years, the most important practical thing you can do is remember the goal. If you forget about the goal, you're not going to get there. You're going to end up somewhere else. And that is what our community is in danger of doing. 5 years from now, there may still be a very popular version of the GNU system, and people might still be calling it Linux by mistake, but it might be shot through with non-free programs at important places in the system, and the idea of using a computer in freedom might be hopeless. So, so I think that what we should do is work harder to remind people of the goal that all of this work was done for, the goal of freedom. One of these problem laws is when algorithms and techniques and features can be patented. The U.S. allows software patents. I believe there are over 100,000 software patents now in the U.S., which means that any software development project is risky. You might get sued. And for this reason, software patents are a foolish policy. Only the multinational software companies benefit from them, because they have such a big list of patents that they can force most companies to cross-license with them. So they escape most of the danger. But for any small software developer, which doesn't have more than a few patents, anytime they develop a large program, they are likely to get sued or threatened one way or another. Any design decision is taking a risk. You might step on a patent and it might blow up your project. So, in effect, developing a large program becomes like crossing a minefield, even though each step is probably not going to step on a patent. It's still a very risky activity to try to walk through the field. Europe right now is considering whether to have software patents. Now, I don't know to what extent they're willing to listen to opinions from a country that's considering joining the EU, but they might, and especially if it comes from businesses. I'm sad to say they pay more attention to businesses than to people simply concerned about the well-being of society. But if you're a business that uses software, then this is something you should be concerned about. And you should take a look at the website petition.eurolinux.org and take a look at what it says there, sign the petition, but also get in touch with them, because they can explain how businesses can help influence the outcome. We do have a chance of defeating this proposal. The other danger, the other kind of law that prohibits development of free software, is the law that's in the U.S. is called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which imposes censorship on the information about the formats of certain data. For example, the format of a DVD is secret, but the only way people can get that information to write a program is if they promise not to make it free software. But there were people who wanted free software so that they could play their DVDs. So they figured out the format, and they published a free program. Most of them, I think there were three people, and two of them kept their identities secret. But one of them said who he was. His name is Jon Johansson. He was 16 years old, and he lives in Norway. And the movie companies pressured the Norwegian government into threatening him with prosecution for writing a program which you could use to play your DVDs. Apparently, the movie companies made so many movies about things man was not meant to know that now they really believe that there are things like the format of DVDs which man was not meant to know. So, it's going to be up to you to fight against these laws in Slovenia or in the European Union. People used to say that we couldn't possibly supply the public with a full spectrum of free software. Well, now we're already, I'd say, within an order of magnitude of doing that. We've come through many orders of magnitude. We only have about one left to go. So we're in the ballpark. Our capability to do the job can no longer be doubted. The only question is, will we be allowed to do the job? And that is a political question that the public will have to fight for. So, I'd like to ask you to read our website, www.gnu.org, and be sure to look at petition.eurolinux.org for the software patents petition. And now I will introduce my alter ego. I am Saint Ignatius of the Church of Emacs. I bless your computer, my child. The Emacs was initially a text editor, which became a way of life for many, and then ultimately a religion. We even have a great schism. And we also now have saints. Fortunately, no gods yet. The Church of Emacs has advantages over some other churches because to be a saint in the Church of Emacs does not require celibacy. However, you do have to live a life of moral purity. You must make the moral commitment and carry it out to exorcise all the evil proprietary operating systems from your computers and install a wholly free operating system, and then only install free software on top of that. If you make this commitment and live by it, then you too will be a saint in the Church of Emacs, and you too may eventually have a halo. By the way, people sometimes ask me if it is a sin in the Church of Emacs to use VI for editing. The answer is that using a free version of VI is not a sin, it's a penance. People also sometimes ask me if my halo is really a computer disk. This is not a computer disk, this is my halo. But it was a computer disk in a former existence. I do not know anything about what kind of computer it came from or what data was stored on it, but I can assure you that no non-free software is accessible on it now. I can benefit from the time when the TV camera isn't pointing at me to scratch my nose. So now I'll ask for questions. Yes. So now I'll ask for questions. Yes, but the definition of, well, first of all, this is only about published information, information that is being made available to the public in one way or another. And I think the proper definition of free is not the same for all kinds of information. Some information is functional, that is, it's used to get a job done. This includes software, recipes, textbooks and manuals and reference works, and maybe some other things as well. And those kinds of things should be free in the same way that software should be free. And so we we now have not only the GNU General Public License for software, but we have the GNU Free Documentation License, which can be used for textbooks and manuals and reference books and recipes or whatever. But other kinds of works serve other purposes, and if you look at the same questions for those kinds of works, you don't, you know, some of the issues are the same and some of the issues are different. Well, that's a totally different issue, because that information we might not want to publish at all.
Why not?
It's a tangent, please. I'm sorry, you're going off on a tangent. The point is that there may be some kinds of information which we would prefer to avoid publishing, but that is not the same thing as publishing it in a proprietary way. You know, letting a company sell copies to whoever wants to pay is not a good way of preventing this harmful information from being available. So if the information, if we consider the information useful and we want it to be available, then we should encourage everyone to copy it, not have somebody basically controlling who can get it purely for his own profit. And we might say that some kinds of information are so dangerous that they shouldn't be released, which means, again, we don't want somebody to be offering it to anybody who's willing to pay and controlling it solely for his own profit. To have somebody controlling it solely for his own profit is the wrong thing for any kind of this of information that tells you how to do something.
Most people...
Let's give someone else a chance, please.
Okay, sorry.
I'm afraid I need you to speak louder, because I can't hear you. I can't hear you.
Okay. If you work, for instance, in movie industry, how could you make a movie if you tend to give it away for free?
Well, I didn't... Remember, I've been talking about freedom. I haven't said anything about give it away.
Okay.
And the other thing is that I've been talking about software. The issues for, say, works of fiction are not the same as for software, because works of fiction are not functional. Part of the issue carries over, and part of it doesn't. To tell people that they can't make copies of a movie for their friend, that is intolerable. That issue carries over to any kind of published information, that part of the issue. But there are other parts of the issue, like, you know, making modified versions, which don't necessarily carry over from functional works to fiction. And so I wouldn't necessarily say that movies should be treated exactly the way software should be treated. I would say that nobody has the right to try to stop you from giving a copy to your friend, but it might be okay to have a copyright system that covers the commercial distribution and use and commercial broadcasting or screening of movies. And this would still be a way of making money from the movies. So there are, for things that are not functional in their nature, there are various intermediate possibilities.
Okay, thank you.
The general idea of copyright was to promote progress by providing a way for authors or others who produce works to get income from them. But it's not done for their sake. It's done to modify their behavior so as to result in cultural progress, which is a benefit to the whole society. And I agree that's a benefit for the whole society. And all else being equal, it makes sense to have an artificial system to encourage such work. Copyright at one time may have been a good way of doing this back in the age of the printing press, when ordinary readers found it not feasible to make copies. You needed a printing press, or For movies, you needed special equipment too to make copies at all, and it only was feasible for mass production. So copyright had the effect of an industrial regulation then. But now it has become an intrusive restriction on every individual. And that's what... So although the purpose is still a useful purpose, the goal of encouraging cultural progress and activity, this method is no longer acceptable because it intolerably restricts people and divides people. So we're going to have to find new ways to achieve that goal. But for non-functional works, a compromised copyright system might still be acceptable. We should reject the idea that we have to have uniform policies for every kind of work. It makes no sense to treat them all the same if that doesn't give good results for all of them. So why shouldn't we have different rules for novels and for movies? You know, if one set of rules works well for novels, but it doesn't work well for movies, we could have different rules for movies. Why not? Uniformity is nice. Simplicity is nice. But the fact is, copyright law is terribly complicated already. And a tiny bit of additional complexity, if that makes our people's lives easier, is well worth it. In fact, the only time people... The demand for uniformity is usually raised by a company that's basically saying, we want to have the maximum power that you decided to give to anybody. It should go to everybody, because that way we get more power, you see. That's the way they think of it. And that approach has to be rejected. Now, I have an idea that I think will work for novelists and musicians to make money from their novels and their music when everybody can copy it. And that is, suppose that only verbatim copying is allowed, which might be okay for novels and for recorded music. Then in the piece or novel as it is published for computers, there would be a record saying how to reach the author or the musicians. And it would be designed so that when you are playing the piece or when you are reading the novel, there's a box on the side of the screen all the time which says, click here to send $1 to the author or to the musicians. Now, that is probably more money than they're going to get if you buy the book or the CD. But it's a small amount of money. It's much less than you would pay for the book or the CD. So I think that in the developed areas of the world, people are going to be willing to pay. Of course, you may not pay every time you read it, of course, but once in a while you'll pay. Because it's such a little amount of money, and people tend to really like their favorite authors and musicians. So I think it should be easy to spread the idea that it's good to keep writers writing and musicians playing by sending a little contribution once in a while. And I think that once we have a system on the internet that makes it cheap and efficient to send a dollar anonymously to somebody, that this will really work. Unfortunately, there is an obstacle right now to setting up that system, which is that at least the method that I know of is covered by patents. And those patents, I think, are something like 12 or 13 years old, which means that they probably have about 7 more years to run. I'm not certain of the precise dates. But eventually, I think we'll be able to do this. Meanwhile, you must beware of ebooks. There is a big commercial marketing push today for ebooks. Now, I have nothing in principle against the idea of publishing books over networks and reading them through a computer if you like to do that. But the way it is being done today involves trampling the freedoms that readers have always had, such as, for example, to lend the book to your friend, to buy a copy from a used bookstore. Have you ever bought a book from a used bookstore? Have you ever borrowed a book from a library? Have you ever purchased a book anonymously without telling anybody who bought the book? All these freedoms are being taken away by e-books as they are proposed today. And so we must reject them vigorously and condemn them. We must show the publishers that we are not so desperate to get these books online that we will throw away our freedoms to do it. More questions?
Yep. I would just like to ask you, do you have any estimation about the extent the GPL license is violated?
Well, every year we hear about a number of companies that are violating it, and we send them letters telling them to stop, and they generally stop once they get letters from our lawyer. There's one company which has been refusing to stop, and we don't quite understand why, but we may have to sue them soon. But I don't think I should say anything more about that now.
Thank you.
One question. You said before that a musician would still play if they got a dollar once in a while.
Well, that's what they get now. You have to realize that the copyright system, that the music industry likes to pretend that they are enforcing copyright for the sake of the musicians. Meanwhile, they are screwing the musicians constantly. You should read the article by Courtney Love that was in, I believe it was Salon magazine, was it? She said, this article is about pirates, namely people that intend to use musicians' work and not pay them for it. These pirates are the record companies. That's what she said. Because I knew that many bands don't get money for their records. But she showed that even bands that were fairly successful ended up getting very little money for their records. The system is designed to really screw the musicians. And yet, the record companies still claim that it's in the name of those same musicians that they are trying to dominate and control and restrict us. I believe that fans sending a dollar once in a while, if it's easy to do, will give the musicians as much money as they get now, by and large. Some might get more, some might get less. Those details vary, of course. But you see, I think a lot of fans would cheerfully send a dollar if only they could do it as easily as snapping their fingers. Right now, to try to send a dollar to some band that you like would be hard work. The dollar wouldn't discourage you, but the hard work of sending it would. You'd have to be really, really determined to actually send a dollar to a band today. But if it were as easy as clicking on a box on your screen when the piece is just played or is playing, I think we would all do that sometimes. And considering that they get less than a dollar if you buy a CD, I think they could get more money that way. And what's more, we would be free of the stupid hype imposed by the music industry. See, I love music. And because of that, I detest the music industry. I don't want music that comes from a factory. I want music that is made by people who love it, and that is listened to by people who love it, because they love it and because they heard about it from other people who love it, and not because it's been advertised everywhere and they've been bombarded with it. So, even aside from the issue of restricting us, I will be glad to see the plug pulled on the hype industrial complex that right now dominates music around the world. And also, one thing that makes me very sad is the way certain kinds of popular music that are popular in the U.S. are crushing other kinds of music all around the world. When I listen to music, it's likely to be music from the Balkans. Or maybe it'll be classical music from India, or music from Bali and Java. I never listen to any of the music that the hype industrial complex puts out because I don't like any of it. But all around the world, all of these other kinds of music are getting lost and forgotten because rock and roll and country and rap and techno are pushing it out of everywhere. And I think that this is going to be a tragedy for humanity comparable to the tragedy of the mass extinction that is going on. And I hope that we can partly avoid it by turning off the hype industrial complex.
Can I just continue with another question?
Yeah.
Just a rhetorical, I'm not sure Metallica or something like this would be satisfied with the system, but what is your suggestion, what would be the price for the, you said you've sold Emacs for $150?
You can sell it for any amount you wish.
Yes, who determines what is the amount?
You do. If you're selling copies, you say, I'll give you a copy for this much, and somebody can either buy it or not. It's up to you and him. There is no rule, you see.
What's the bottom line?
What?
What's the bottom line? What's the least?
There isn't. It's entirely if you're offering to sell it and he wants to buy it, it's between you and him.
Okay.
There is no rule.
So who pays for lunch?
I don't understand you. I'm sorry.
Okay.
You're giving me a hard time. Somebody else might have a more intelligent question.
Can I? I don't know whether it's going to be more intelligent, but I admire your suggestion about paying a dollar if you're on a site of your favorite author. But before finding a site of your favorite author and to become a fan, this favorite author has to be, there has to be the whole industry of...
No, not anymore.
Before Courtney Love became what she is today, I think that the record company industry made a huge promotion of her.
Yes,
and I definitely agree with your suggestion how to substitute the copyright law, but I cannot find a way, and I would really like to, how to cut out the record companies for doing the work of promotion.
I think that if everybody can copy the music on the internet, people will pass the music around to their friends, and that will promote it. In the old days, when that wasn't possible, you know, when people didn't have computers, there was no way for people to get copies except to buy records. So musicians needed record companies. It was the only way to get the music copies to people. There was no way to make people aware of the music except to have radio stations play it. Which, of course, radio stations could still do, you know. We don't need to have record companies to have radio stations broadcast the music. It's just that today the radio stations are part of the hype industrial complex, so they will only play things if the record companies pay them to. But if we get rid of that system, then the radio stations will still look for music to play, but maybe they'll find it by going around and listening and seeing what they like, instead of by seeing which record companies will give them some kind of kickback or something. So so I think that there will be two methods of publicity. One is radio stations will still be doing it, and two, word of mouth. And, you know, when people can send a copy of any piece of music to their friends, they're going to do that. And so if people like a certain piece of music, it's just going to spread, and soon there'll be lots and lots of fans. By the way, I should correct it. It's not a matter of looking at the site of that musician. Instead, my idea is that the actual piece of recorded music will be in a file that is set up so that when you play the music, there will be a box that you can click on to send a dollar. And if you decide to send a copy of the piece to your friend, well, when your friend plays it, the box will appear also. You won't have to go looking for a site. You just have to get a copy of the music from your friend and listen to it, and it will offer you the chance to send a dollar.
I agree with you, but with your formulation, you then admit that you have only cyberspace music and cyberspace cutting off record companies. But
as I think it's okay if copyright still applies to the commercial pressing of records. So as long as people are buying records, there could still be record companies, I guess, and they could still screw musicians the way they do now, if that's what people want. I'm not saying that we all have to stop buying records. If we want to buy records, I'm not against it. I buy records. Either we will move to distributing music on the internet or we won't. If we're still buying records, there can still be record companies and they'll still be making money. If people stop buying records and there can't be record companies because we're all listening to music through the internet, then these methods of publicizing things through the internet ought to work very well.
I buy a piece of your theory, but there are some other... I will continue. I don't want to be stopped as none.
Okay, then let's give someone else a chance.
Do you have any idea of what kind of license do we need for genetic map and for genomes?
I don't know. I guess I tend to believe that all those things should simply be available for public use, unlimited. I don't believe that there's any public benefit in allowing patenting certainly of natural genes. Whether there should be patents for artificially created genes, I'm not sure, but certainly for natural genes, there should be no patents, period. So no license is needed, because they're not copyrightable either.
Can we go back to the software, please? The freedom which we are talking tonight about is basically the freedom of me as user of the software, which I acquired from somewhere, that I have these three levels of rights, right?
Three different freedoms, yes.
Yeah, three different freedoms, and I guess you can also arrange them as levels.
No, actually, it's better not to.
Okay.
Because, you see, you need all of these freedoms. It's not a matter of levels. I just gave them numbers.
Right,
so
but
I
if I have the freedom which you numbered as number three, I also have a freedom number two and one, I think.
But the point is you've got to have them all, so it's not a matter
okay.
of different levels.
Yeah. So let's say that I have all of them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there is somebody with this devil, who is not the demon from BSD even, and this guy wants to make some money on me, of course, on the software he did. Fine, that's basically the thing which you explained before, the agreement between whoever buys and whoever sells. No problem with that as well. But this... devil is a part of, as well as the demon, saying, well, I want to help you somehow to have the freedom to do this thing, but...
I'm confused. I'm sorry. You're being so cryptic. I don't understand.
So
could
put it this way.
Straight to the point?
Yeah, the point is here, I want to have a freedom on this, with the software, and the guy there says, okay, you have all the freedom, but whoever takes this freedom from you, or wants to get this freedom from you has to send something to me.
Postcard. Then it's not free software anymore.
Not even a postcard.
No.
Okay, but that is basically the problem which happened to GNU, isn't it?
Is it? I don't know. I mean, you're making something up. I don't know what
no,
you're
no,
talking
I'm
about.
Asking. I'm not making up. No. I'm just asking. Because what
no.
happened now with the Linux, everybody's saying Linux is whatever it is, but
they,
basically...
No,
the,
you're confusing two separate issues.
Am
the
I?
People, yes. The people who are mistakenly calling the system Linux, they are distributing the software legitimately.
Right, but the credit was taken away.
Well,
it's not clearly pronounced.
I'm sorry, I disagree with you. I don't believe that they should have been legally prohibited from this. I don't agree.
No, I'm not
I
saying
think that they are doing something that is not nice and it is not right, but they are respecting the freedom of the users. And that's exactly what the GNU GPL says they must do. It's there to protect the freedom of the users.
No,
in addition, please, you said something that is not true, and now I want to explain why it is not true. In addition, for the individual programs, which, after all, the individual programs are released under various licenses, for the individual programs, they're giving credit to the authors of those individual programs. What they are failing to do is to give the credit for the development of the system as a whole. But you see, the system as a whole doesn't have any license. The license applies to the individual programs. And they're different licenses. Different programs have different licenses put on by the developers of those programs. So you see, it's a second level issue which the licenses of the individual programs can't apply to, can't have anything to say about. They are giving credit properly to the authors of each program. What they are failing to say is that the GNU project as a whole, overall, is responsible for the existence of the system as a whole.
This is exactly my point.
No, there's no way we couldn't... There's simply... It would be ridiculous in the license of this one particular program to say something about what name you should use for some larger system.
Is it ridiculous?
Yes, it would be ridiculous. We would be being very bad by trying to put something in the license to restrict that. And we're not going to do it.
No, I'm not suggesting. I'm just asking because, well, what copyleft is basically is a token which, if you get it, you have to pass it for... You have right to pass it...
Copyleft is a method of protecting the user's freedom.
Exactly.
And it is, in general, working to protect the user's freedom.
It's perfectly working.
Right. There is this company we may have to sue soon. But
so it's still working, but that's a legal question.
But the point is that getting recognition for the overall development of the GNU project is a different issue. The GPL is not designed for that, and it shouldn't be.
Indeed, it is designed to protect the user.
And that's what it does.
It does. But I'm trying to make a different point here that making or giving a full credit to FFF...
I think that would be wrong. I'm sorry. I won't put that in a license. I don't believe in putting something in a license for that because it just doesn't fit with the license for any particular program.
Wouldn't it help society?
I'm sorry. Let's drop the subject. I've told you what my opinion is. I mean, you can have a different opinion, but we've discussed it now and I think it's time for something else.
My question is, have you seen the proposal for GPL third revision? And what are your feelings
on that? I'm sorry, what? Have I seen what?
Have you seen... There has been a proposal on the third revision of GPL.
I don't know what you mean. I am working on a third revision. Uh-huh. I am going to produce a third version at some point.
Isn't it too restrictive in some points?
What?
Restrictive.
I'm sorry, I can't understand you. I'm working on a version 3 of the GPL. I'm working on it very slowly. And it will be a long time before there is something to show people.
Okay.
But before it's ready, I will show it to the public and ask for comments, probably in several different places and more than once. There will be no fundamental change in the idea that it's to protect this list of freedoms, but some details will be changed.
If we don't have any more serious questions, I would like to ask Richard to sing with us Fritz Loster's song for the end. Is that okay?
Are there any more questions?
Not a very serious question. If we win, what will we do with all the out-of-work lawyers?
Oh, we could train them to do something useful. Well, maybe lawyers eat other lawyers. So they might dispose of each other for us. So, bye. So should I, are there any other questions? Are there any serious questions or... I think you'll need the microphone. I'm not hearing. Okay.
Have you found any legislative systems which are incompatible with the GPL or where the GPL doesn't stand up to protect?
It's hard to be sure. The GPL is based on copyright law, and copyright law is, to a certain extent, is the same everywhere because of a treaty called the Bern Convention. So we think that copyleft ought to work, that the GPL ought to work, but, you know, we haven't studied it according to various countries' laws because it's a lot of work to do that.
Was there a lawsuit where it was involved?
There has never yet been a lawsuit about the GPL.
Thanks.
Sun has just released its Star Office product under the GPL license. Do you think that the project of that scale has a future without some support? Because I don't know.
I don't understand. I mean, why not? The whole GNU/Linux system is a lot bigger than that. And
yeah, but now the new developers got like 3 million or 30 million lines of code that only were
the
worked.
The system is a lot bigger than that.
Yeah, I know, but it was...
I think you're just imagining difficulties based on speculation, and I don't think that's a useful thing to do. I'm sorry to say that you just imagine that now we're going to have some new difficulties and I'm supposed to prove it's not true. Well, I can't prove it's not true, but you're being unreasonable. If you want to see imaginary possible problems, you can see them anywhere. And we can never prove they're not true, except that time will tell. So that's not a useful way to approach things. The useful thing to do is to look for is to solve problems, not imagine difficulties. That's just a recipe for defeating yourself.
One quick question, if possible. With all this ideology, the greedy still benefit and the hardworking lose, or, well,
I'm
don't gain
don't
as much as the greedy.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Okay, if I only take, I gain more than if I also give. How to balance this?
I don't think we should try. The alternative of proprietary software is much worse because then you have somebody taking far, far more and profiting by hurting people.
Thanks.
So basically, if I have to choose between two alternatives, in one of them, I get a lot of money and I don't deserve it. And the other, I deserve it, but I don't get it. I'd rather deserve it and not get it. Because at least then I can feel I don't have to be ashamed of myself. If I were developing proprietary software, I would be building walls to divide people. So it's better to develop no software than develop proprietary software. So if you can't find a way to develop free software, at least develop no software. That's the next best thing. It avoids actively participating in subjugating other people. And, of course, it's even better to be developing free software because then you're contributing to the world. Now, what we see today is it is possible to make money from working on free software. It doesn't have to be just a sacrifice for the community. And I think that's a good thing. I'm glad to see people making money from contributing to free software. But I personally, I'm more interested in seeing how I can do more to benefit the world than in getting more money. You know, if I were starving, then my priority would be to get money so I could stay alive. But I seem to be in no particular danger of dying, right? So I don't need to make that my priority. I have the option. I have the opportunity to aim for a higher ambition, which is to try to make the world a better place.
If there are no more questions, I'd like to thank again Mr. Stolman, and thank you all for attending this speech. Thank you.